submitting to the termination petition. Yeah. That's the termination petition.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's submitting that on the record. The next case on our calendar is consolidated case A19-0954 and A19-0991. And for this one, do we have all counsel present for this one?
Yes, sir.
Will we be splitting time between counsel for appellants?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Jeremy Blackwell. I'm going to try to do 7 minutes.
So just to be clear, you will have 7 minutes, did you say?
Yes.
And then Mr. Mack will have 8 minutes?
Yes.
And then Mr. Mack will be responding on rebuttal then?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So for this matter, in the matter of the welfare of the children of DLT and JAP parents, we will set the timer for 7 minutes for you, Mr. Blackwelder. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, you may proceed.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Jeremy Blackwelder. I'm from Suquamish, Granite Falls. I'm representing appellant mother, Deanna Toohey, in this case. This is a case that clearly these children had significant injuries. The question comes up is how these injuries happened. The mother in this case and the father in this case.
Is the question of how did it happen, or is the question of where did it happen?
I believe the question is how and where. The parents in this case allege that the children have a genetic defect, OI, osteoinfectia. I may not be pronouncing that right. I know I'm not, but I'm going to refer to it as OI. They indicate that the children had what's commonly known as brittle bone disease. And with that, these children would be more susceptible to injuries.
So was there expert testimony from the parents that an expert examined these children and concluded that they had this condition?
The parents did not have any expert testimony that concluded they had this condition, no.
So they just argued it.
There was an expert from the state.
They just argued it.
Pardon me?
They just argued it.
They argued it, yes.
And there was a doctor who suggested that his examination of eyes were inconsistent with that claim. Is that right?
Dr. Vargas indicated, it's on page 9 of my brief, which indicates where it is in the transcript, that it's unlikely that they had. He didn't eliminate OI as the cause of these injuries. He just merely said it was unlikely.
Why isn't that sufficient?
He said it was unlikely after some information about their eyes. Is that right?
He said it was unlikely due to some information that was provided that they had asked for some family background from the parents in this case. The families, two parents in this case, came from severely broken homes. We really didn't know a lot about their extended family to see if they had any history of this. A normal parent who has two parents in a normal family home would know enough about their father and their mother and their grandpa and grandma on each side to know whether they'd have some significant condition like OI.
Well, just because you come from a broken home, counsel, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't know what your family history is and family medical history. My recollection from the record is that not only did the doctor question them, but asked them as well as whether their parents had brittle bone disease or if it was in the family, and the answer was no. In addition to, as Judge Klopaki pointed out, the doctor himself, after examining the children, said he doesn't see any presence of OI here. So what merit is there in this argument? I guess is my question.
She indicated that she had information that one of her grandparents may have had the brittle bones disease, but she just didn't know enough information about it to be able to relate it to
the doctor. The trial court specifically found that they do not suffer from the genetic disorder OI. Is that right?
The judge did find that, and I believe that is an error.
Well,
because she's relying
so
on
you're claiming that that's a clearly erroneous finding.
I don't believe that's clearly supported by the evidence in this case.
Wait a minute. No, our standard of review is whether it is clearly erroneous.
Yes.
Why is it clearly erroneous?
I believe there are indications that they should have looked further into this. There was testimony at trial that there was an indication in the medical file that the children had blue screen tint to the eyes. The doctor Dr. Vargas, didn't see that in the file. Had he looked closer at the file, he would have seen that. Perhaps he could have done the testing that he supposed could have been provided in this case to these children to see whether or not they have one. He indicated there was genetic blood testing that could have been done that was not done. He recommended eye testing, which was not done until much later in the case, to determine whether or not they had the bluish gray tint.
So it sounds like you're saying that there is a potential that they may have had OI. But to Judge Klopaki's point, how does that make the district court's finding clearly erroneous when we have in the record support for that finding on the basis of an interview with the parents where they indicate that they don't have it and their parents don't, and that the doctor said it's unlikely after examining the child? Those two seem to support the district court's conclusion that, or finding, that it is not present. So how can that finding be clearly erroneous?
I believe there wasn't enough research here, investigation by the county and by the doctor to determine that it was.
Did you make a motion for amended findings on this finding?
Your Honor, I was not the
Did anybody make a motion for amended findings on this subject?
I do not believe there was any post-trial motions until this notice of appeal was filed.
But, you know, we're a review court, not a trial court. So we go by standards of review, and when there's a finding, and unless you can show that it was clearly erroneous, that's the end of that subject, it seems to me. Notwithstanding that you maybe could have or should have or whatever, added some more information. Yeah, you could comment on that.
Again, my argument is contained in the brief. I believe the judge's order is going beyond what the doctor is stating. The doctor does not state these children do not have OI. He just simply says it's unlikely. I don't know where that determination that the children do not have OI is coming from. I don't believe that there's enough evidence in the case for her to come to that conclusion. I believe that's what makes it clearly erroneous. There's also discussion during this case about whether or not the efforts had been reasonable in this case. I raised that in my brief. The state argues that the efforts didn't apply because there was a determination that after the trial, and actually at the pretrial, the police at the admit deny when efforts, the court seized the county for their relieving of their efforts. From the beginning of the case, September 11th, 2018 through March 19th, when the efforts were seized, there should have been additional efforts provided in this case. I believe the efforts that are not properly identified in the court's order, although it's very, very lengthy order, I don't believe the efforts are properly identified. What happened between September 11th and March 1st? I see my minutes are up.
Didn't the trial court advise the county that they didn't have to make reasonable efforts because the allegation was of the nature it is, that is egregious harm?
7 months into this case, that determination was made. So for the first 7 months, the court had not relieved the county of efforts, and therefore the county should have been providing reasonable efforts. So the county's attempting to do there is say, okay, since that the pretrial, the TPR, we don't have to do reasonable efforts from then on. They're trying to retroactively apply that back to the first 7 months of the case.
Thank you, counsel.
If you will, I'd appreciate turning to ADD 45 in my initial brief, finding 153. It is not possible to determine whether it was Mr. Toohey or Ms. Patton or Mr. Patton who harmed Isabella and Gabriella or both.
Which finding
only
is that?
Isabella, Gabriella. Pardon me?
Give me that reference again.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
153.
About 45, finding 153.
Thank you.
Now, this is a case. position either that Ms. Tuohy did it, or Mr. Patton did it, or that somebody else did it, but they knew about it and took no efforts to stop it. There is no such evidence at all in the file. The only thing that we have is suspicion that it must have been the parents. But there are various reasons to say that it may not have been the parents. For example, during this period of time, before the doctor made the determination that there were 30 or more bones broken, they were seen by various medical providers, and they were seen for colds, and there was no suspicion before that time that bones had been broken. That suggests one of two things. Either the bones were broken suddenly at a time fairly close to the time that the doctor took a look at the children, or that it was very difficult to determine that the child had broken bones or the other child had broken bones without a medical examination. As a result of this, it's perfectly possible that the parents were unaware of the fact that the child had been abused to the extent that the children were. I would concede that if the parents knew that there had been serious damage to their child or that they had done it, that that would be culpably unfit. But you can't simply say that someone is culpably unfit because there's a strong suspicion that they did something. You've got to have some direct evidence. And
why do you have to have direct evidence, counsel? The statute says that under subdivision 1B6 that involuntary termination can take effect if that child has experienced egregious harm in the parent's care. It doesn't say anything about the parent or parents harming the child. All that matters is the harm occurred, the egregious harm occurred while in the parent's care. That's not refuted, is it?
I think it is, because I think the words "in the parent's care" means while they were in the parent's care. And if the egregious harm happened because the brother or stepfather or somebody else did this to the children, and the children did not evidence symptoms to the parent. But look where you would be going with this. Let's say, hypothetically, that the parents went on a vacation for a week. And let's say while they were in the babysitter's care, the babysitter broke their bones. And let's say that the parents came back and didn't notice anything wrong with the children. Surely the statute cannot mean that, because there has to be some kind of a relationship between the care of the parent and the egregious harm to the child. So I respectfully disagree with your analysis of that.
Well, let's go back to your point on finding 153. The district court says it is not possible to determine whether it was father or mother who harmed the child, but the district court said one or the other did, and the other basically is an accomplice to what occurred here, and neither one of them is being up front. Why isn't? I'll just finish my thought real quick. Excuse me. Why isn't that enough? The fact that the district court said I can't determine which parent it was, but it was one of these two parents.
It doesn't say that though. It says it is not possible to determine whether it was Ms. Tuohy or Mr. Patton who harmed Isabella or Gabriella or both. And reading that sentence the way that it should be properly read, it does not say but one of them did it. It simply says it's not possible A, it's not possible B. So taking it back to elementary logic, if that was to say what Judge Ray, as you think it says, it would have to say maybe A, maybe B, maybe both, maybe neither. And that's the proper way, I think, to read that sentence.
But Mr. Mack?
Reasons why, yes.
Do we need to resolve that? Isn't it enough that the district court found that that these children were seriously injured, and then makes a finding that neither parent is capable of placing the need of physical safety of the children ahead of their own need for fulfillment in their romantic partner relationship? When you have children that have these serious injuries and this finding, why isn't that enough to say?
Because that finding has to be based upon a parents knew or should have known of the children's condition, and two, that the parents either did it themselves or knew that it was being done by somebody else. Otherwise, the finding that you just recited doesn't have a foundation.
And I agree with you, Mr. Mack, that it is a knew or should have known. So why isn't that, when this harm, all this harm that these children went through, why is it that the parents who were watching them and with them the vast majority of the time, why is it that they should not have known about the harm that they experienced?
The answer is that they were seen by various medical providers all throughout that summer who also didn't suspect it. Also, the judge herself notes that this may have been hard to find because the children were young. They might have cried out for other reasons, or they might have not cried out insufficient verbosity, bad word, to put the parents on notice that there was something wrong. After all, these parents were bringing the children to medical providers during this entire time, and it stands to reason that if they had either suspected the broken bones or they'd broken it themselves, they wouldn't have done that. Is that conclusive? No, but it also isn't conclusive that the parents either knew about this or should have known about it or did it themselves. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, Shane Baker, Canada County Attorney for respondent. My brief was pretty lengthy, so give me a misnomer to the name, about 38 pages on the findings. I did that here because I think it was important to know that it is the standard review that's so important here. It's what's the court's actual findings, to lay those out as it goes through a lot of these points. I'll address the father's situation first. First of all, the county submits he did not challenge the termination on failure to comply with parental duties. This court only needs to find one factor to affirm a termination. That basis alone allows the court to affirm the district court order without referring to any of the other issues the father raised. If the court goes into those other issues, I think the TP Supreme Court decision is an important place to start on these issues. It involves a very similar factual situation with a young child receiving broken bones and a question of which parent did it, or what do you do when there's no finding of that. We do have the district court's finding that doesn't say which parent. But finding 153 is clear that she is saying it's one or the other, or both. It's not the maternal grandmother, it's not the paternal grandmother. Other findings lay out why they weren't involved enough in the child's life, not around them. She weighed the evidence and made that 153 finding. So, with the TB decision, they say it's a no or should have known. So, when father argues whether he knew under this egregious harm factor, it's should have known. And the Court of Appeal, shortly after this decision in TP, came out with MLA, which I cited in my brief regarding how that test is applied. And they noted that if you have a situation where that parent is the one who caused it, the TP test doesn't apply. Or if it does, then they took through a number of the facts, such as the medical care revealed it, and some of the other things as mentioned in that case. So
in TP, the court said the court must find that the parent either knew or should have known. Do we have that kind of finding in the trial court here?
I believe you do when you see how finding 153 is worded, is because when she goes to the effort of excluding all other causes such as OI and that situation, that she makes findings that it child abuse. And then 153, when she excludes the grandmothers and says it's there's only four people that know who did it, and except for the young children, the victims here, that it's the parents. That, I think, is sufficient to meet that standard.
You remember that TP, the Supreme Court, reversed for and remanded, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
To address whether the mother knew or should have known of the egregious harm because it could not determine this issue from the record. Well, we don't have the record here either, do we?
There's a trial court transcript.
We have a full transcript?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. But we don't have a trial court finding that one parent or the other parent knew or should have known. I think you're suggesting that we should infer that from the finding the trial court made.
Yes. I'm not saying there's any specific words citing DP and saying mom should have known or father should have known or knew. That verbiage is not in there. That is correct. We're saying you infer it from the 100 and some other findings of fact and how they relate to that issue. And I agree, if that's not deemed sufficient, then it's to remand to consider that factual issue. Let's see, we're about halfway through. Let me go to the case against the mother. First of all, I know for her, she didn't raise this issue, so it would not apply to her, granting her relief. Secondly, hers are more focused on whether the evidence is sufficient. I do think it's very important to, as Judge Klopbach noted, the standard of review. And I think it's even important to lay out what that means, not just clearly erroneous. The court has said in other cases, this means it is either manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole.
We have some cases that also say or against logic. Any one of those would suffice.
This is on page 38, I'm quoting, that's where I'm getting these quotes. And then, determining sufficiency of evidence, appellate courts defer to the district court's findings, and considerable deference is due to the district court's decision because the district court is in a superior position to assess the credibility of witnesses. And I think that's what's going on with the mother situation. There is evidence here from the doctors that said it was from physical or child abuse. Dr. Hudson, just quoting from my brief at 49, found that the brain bleed from abusive head trauma. He's very confident that this was an inflicted injury. Regarding the rib back fractures, he says very specific for abusive injury, the result of squeezing very, very forcefully around the chest. He found no other explanations for that. Regarding OI, those were considered. Dr. Vargas said he did not see any fracture prompting him to think the causes of the fractures were genetic. And he talked about how blood testing is not done in all cases. And that's the issue. There is evidence here that the judge relied on. And mom is just simply re-arguing the evidence they submitted and say that should show that this is clearly erroneous. That's not the appellate court's job. There's sufficient evidence regarding mom. With regards to the reasonable efforts for egregious harm, statute 260.012 talks about that reasonable efforts are not required in a case where there's a prima facie determination that it's a certain type of case. Egregious harm is one of those cases. So it's not as though the court should grant permission up until that point they should be doing reasonable efforts. We have a prima facie case for egregious harm. County doesn't need to provide reasonable efforts whatsoever.
Counsel was objecting to the 7-month delay. What was it? Is it true that it took 7 months for the trial court to come to that determination?
I can't say why there was a delay in the findings. Sometimes the findings just not made right away.
But
it doesn't mean that it's not seen to meet the standard.
But if there was a delay of 7 months, wouldn't the county have an obligation to provide reasonable services up until the point that the district court says you don't have to anymore?
I would think the county would not have to in that situation, given it's the egregious harm case. The danger counties always run into is, you can see, it's on the egregious harm here. What if your honors decide that, based on that factor, that it wasn't met for some reason? If the county relied solely on the fact that it's an egregious harm case and did not provide reasonable efforts, every other factor does require reasonable efforts. We would be setting ourselves up time and time again for remands to institute those reasonable efforts. And there may be situations where providing those can lead to beneficial outcomes for families too. So, you know, it's not parity. It's better to provide the efforts right from the get-go. So, and that's some of the issue here is, on the other factors, the palpably unfit and the parental duties, as far as it goes with mom, is the judge, I don't know what finding number exactly, I believe I cited it, talked about that the county didn't have to provide reasonable efforts. She didn't make a specific finding that there were reasonable efforts. And as much as that may be in the record, there was no specific finding on that. So as with regards to the Bonds case, we're relying on that it was egregious harm shown. Because I think what would end up happening is remand, at least for that finding on whether, up until that point, the efforts provided were reasonable. So I guess in summary, with Dad, he failed to raise one issue. That alone allows for termination. I believe MLA provides the basis where there's egregious harm and the known or should have known standard, and that's laid out in the court's various findings. There was a reference to the parental capacity. That's not what the court relied on exclusively, certainly in this case. And besides, the Frymack issue wasn't raised by the trial court attorney, so it's deemed waived. And with that, I have no other argument. And if the court has any other questions, I'll answer those. Otherwise, that's it.
We do not. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Mack.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Mr. Mack, the county attorney just suggested that you didn't object to every one of the grounds the trial court found for termination, and that therefore you're in effect admitting one of the grounds exists and it should be affirmed on that basis. Your reaction?
Well, my submission is that the minor grounds in this case, for example, let's suppose that the court was wrong on egregious harm and palpable unfitness, which I suspect are the same things. Then there would have been a duty to provide reasonable services, and reasonable services were cut off. So any of the minor grounds should fail as well.
You agree, however, that you did not object to what you describe as minor grounds? You didn't cite that as the basis for your appeal?
I cited as a basis for appeal the egregious harm and palpable unfitness, and I submit that those automatically excise the other two as well. Now, if I may go to ADD 20, because I think this is important, there are two findings of the court which relate to this case. 72 says, the reason why a skeletal survey is performed is that young infants can have injuries that are not apparent to outside observers. The child would likely give some indication that a fracture had occurred, but it would be very difficult to know or read those indications. It might also be less apparent that an infant is in pain than it would be for an adult. So it is entirely possible that if a third party was responsible for the injuries of the child, the parents wouldn't know and shouldn't have had to know that the child had the egregious injuries that they had had. So let's turn to finding 70 in the last sentence. All of the fractures show signs of healing. They could have happened all at the same time. So that's an indication, and I think that makes sense. Reading those two together then, if these happened at the same time in the presence of a third party or by the action of a third party, and they were not easily discoverable by anyone, absent a skeletal survey, then the parents shouldn't have
been held liable for them.
But there were more injuries than simply the fractures, were there not?
Pardon me?
Weren't there more injuries than just weren't there other injuries beyond the fractures?
There were a few, but they weren't terribly concerning. And the ones that were concerning to the court, for example, that I recall one of the children had a cough, one of them had an upper respiratory disease, and so forth.
But wasn't there a mark on the face of one of them?
I think there was a mark on the face of one of them, but that, of course, was not determined to be caused by either a human hand or other agency.
Wasn't there also wasn't there also brain bleed?
Pardon me? That I'm not sure of.
Right, because the soft spot was hard when the doctor examined the child, which indicated that there's a subdural hematoma. In other words, bleeding on the brain.
Now, let's be honest about this. It's obvious that somebody did this. One or more persons did it, possibly one person did it. But the thing is, it's a terrible thing to accuse somebody of as serious a crime as this obviously was, probably assault 2, certainly assault 3. Without any definitive proof, these people were never tried.
Right, but Mr. Mack, you're talking about whether criminal charges should be filed or not, and I understand from your briefing you highlight that and indicate that perhaps the county should have pursued further to find out what exactly happened. But the fact of the matter here is we have a TPR case. It's not reasonable. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. We've got clear and convincing evidence standard of review. And when I look at the district court's very lengthy and very detailed order, and in particular 153, it says it's not possible to determine whether it's father or mother, but only 4 people know, the children or father and mother. And there's nothing in there that says it's possible that a third party may have injured the children. And therefore, nevertheless, the parents knew or should have known about that. That is clearly focused on only 2 people. Either one of them did it or both of them injured those children. I don't think it can be read any other way.
I think it can be. And if the court had meant to say what you say it said, it should have said it is not possible to determine whether it was Mrs. Tooley or Mr. Patton who armed Isabella or Gabriella or both, but one of them did it, and the court didn't say that, and furthermore didn't have any basis for saying it.
Well, if there's a third party that may have done it. The district court excluded any other party and focused solely on the parents, right?
I don't see where it excluded any other party. It simply didn't mention them. It seems to me that if you're going to say it had to be one of those 2 people, you better say it. And if Isabella and Gabriella know but can't say because they're too young, they might have seen it at the hands of a third party as well. So I don't think that the court made the finding, and I don't think it had the basis for the finding. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thank you to all the counsel for your briefing and your oral arguments. We will be issuing an order within the statutory time frame with respect to this one. I believe it is 45-day. That is the last case on our calendar for today. And with that, court is adjourned. Thank you all.
All rise.